Cherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Cherry. Tonight we're going to chat with Dr. Elliot Hamoff. He's a documentary filmmaker and an author. We're going to talk about his work with NASA and all the different projects he had. It's really a fascinating chat. Here's Elliot. Hi, Elliot. Welcome to the show.
Greetings. I mean, this is an unparalleled privilege and an honor to be here with you today.
That's really sweet. Thank you.
It is. Well, I feel honored.
Why? What's the honor?
Well, being able to tell my stories and to interact with you and to meet your audience for the first time.
Yeah, my audience is very cool. They will love you. So that's
well,
fine.
Let us hope. From your mouth to God's ears.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you? It's for a change, it's not too hot out here in sunny Southern California.
I know, isn't it nice? It's been that darn hurricane off Mexico has been like churning humidity and heat. So maybe it just dissipated because I didn't hear it actually became a hurricane. It's just been hell for the last month and a half.
Well, it has. I mean, and my sister that lives in Palm Springs, it's been over like 110 degrees the entire month of August.
I know.
And so she's been having a hard time.
It's not even dry heat. It's humid because of the hurricane. So it's awful.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're used to as L.A. or Southern California natives is dry heat in August. And when it's not, it's just not nice.
That's true.
But, you know, I guess we'll all survive. And it's nicer, right in time for the holiday.
Right, exactly.
Which is very nice. that the weather got nice in time for the holiday, so you're not broiling.
Absolutely.
You have any plans for Labor Day?
No, I'm just going to take it easy, and I'm going with a friend to a polo match in Santa Barbara.
Cool.
So
I love
polo. For the first time.
I've seen a few games. The first time I ever saw it was at a charity event, and Stephanie Powers was one of the polo players. It was really cool. It was for the William Holden Wildlife Foundation.
Oh, wow. Well, so I'm going to look forward to that event. And so, and then to just take it easy, we just finished a book on astronauts called Space Pioneers, and we're getting started on another project called Regenerative Medicine next.
Cool.
So we're happy campers. We're keeping busy off the streets, that's for sure.
Well, now it's nice that you get a little respite between books.
Yeah.
Little one, even if it's only the weekend, you know. Yeah, everybody needs to rest.
Well, right, but we have always have projects. We always have projects and books on our plate. So we're happy campers after 35 years. I'm just happy that people are still wanting my services.
Well, one of the questions I have for you is, when you were a kid, were you reading science fiction?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was watching all the Star Trek shows. I was a 9-year-old in elementary school, so that must have been like 1964 and 1965. And I remember clearly that the school, like, they shut down, and they had all the students go into the auditorium for a Gemini launch. It was, like, just such a unique event that they shut down all of the school and they had everybody go into the auditorium and they wheeled out a TV set. There was like, you know, this small TV, black and white TV, and they had us all watch this Gemini launch. And so that's what really what hooked me onto the science, into you know, being a sci-fi fan. I, as most kids, when they're like 8, 9 years old, they all want to be astronauts.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I was raised by a dad who's a science fiction nut. He actually met Albert Einstein.
Oh, wow.
He was one of the heads of Science Fiction Club at Lincoln High School in Brooklyn, New York. And a bunch of the people who were running science fiction clubs were invited to the big library in New York. I think it's called the Central Library. The one with the big lions in front. And Albert Einstein was the speaker, and he was talking about the future of science and space and all that stuff. And, I mean, it made him even more of a science fiction, but I think it actually made him a science fan, too.
Well, that just being there, I can absolutely understand how awe-inspired he must have felt like, and just wanting to breathe his air, because I have the exact same story from when I was at Cambridge University in England back in the late 1970s and early 80s, when Stephen Hawking was giving lectures out there, and I went to a lecture of his, and I was totally amazed at how many people were surrounding him just wanting to breathe his air and just to get his stories, because they were so visionary. So it just relates back to your father meeting Albert Einstein. I totally get how inspired he must have become.
He was like a I think he was like 13. He was a teenager.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm sure he was freaking out inside when he was meeting Albert Einstein. But he never, he didn't talk about that part. He just talked about how cool it was and how nice and friendly and down to earth he was, and that he went to lunch with him afterwards and everything. I mean, just really nice man.
Right. Well, I can imagine. But this is all the kind of thing that most people, they can, take some benefit in, you know, them meeting famous people at one point or another.
Oh, yeah.
That it happens to all of us at some point.
Yeah. And it's just, it lit up even more his interest in science. He already was a science fiction fan, but he was, he started studying more about science, which is why the space program was such a cool thing to him.
Well, and that was exactly my situation, that, you know, it's like I was 9 or 10, and I'm seeing these launches, and I wanted to become an astronaut, and then when I became a TV science producer, it's like the opportunity to put together like a TV documentaries, I couldn't refuse it. I mean, and I gotta tell you the story, because it's such a funny story, is that I was at a Christmas party back in 1993, which is a way back, and a bunch of us were talking about the old Pulp Fiction era between World War I and World War II, and the sci-fi Don novels at the time that were written by L. Ron Hubbard, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Fred Pohl, you know, and all the other kind of people about space travel and going to the moon and colonizing the moon and Mars and beyond. And then during that conversation led to how those old-time writers about space travel became a reality with such scary accuracy that she whispered in my ear that in July, the next July of 1994, that would be the 25th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon, and wouldn't it be a great idea to do a documentary on all the real-life astronauts who walked on the moon, and that the show could be marketed on the coattails of that anniversary. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. And as fate would have it, we literally bumped into Al Reinert at the Space Museum in Houston while we're filming for that documentary, who was the writer of the big Tom Hanks blockbuster Apollo 13, and he gave us great ideas for other Apollo and astronaut shows to produce. So it was kind of like, I was already prepared and prepped for doing these kinds of documentaries with my colleagues to do like a space and astronaut show. When we heard about these Pulp Fiction guys that wrote about space travel, and then it's like there was such a tremendous response that we ended up producing over a dozen space and astronaut shows. Most of them are still available on a wide variety of streaming sites, and even DVDs for us old timers can even be still found on Amazon. So so that was the genesis for all of these documentaries we did on space and astronauts and space travel and profiles of these heroic guys. I mean, just they, and then to interview them was just so awe-inspiring.
So when you started doing them and you were interviewing these great people, was it something that just came together, or did somebody bring them together for you, or how did it work, or did you chase after them?
for the documentaries of these space missions, is like this was, don't forget, this was like in the 1990s and into the 2000s, and so all that was produced were like the NASA stories. And so those were tended to be more bland, more corporate structured, more stoic, almost like less adjectives. And so when we contacted them, and then it was like so funny that when we contacted like one group of astronauts, there would be like they would all talk amongst each other, and then like other astronauts would call us up and say, well, how come you're interviewing these guys and not us? And so it's like we had to interview like all of the other guys, and so then it's like we were interviewing so many of these astronauts that they were really coming out of the woodwork. And you want to know why? It's because we told them that we did not want the bland story, corporate stories. We wanted the behind the scenes. We wanted the playful. We wanted the the touchy feely kind of stories. And they were just like telling us. I mean, like it's like that's one of the reasons why the documentaries were so successful, is because we were interviewing these guys and they were saying how they left a Bible on the rover. And they had a family portrait that they took up and they left it on the moon, to commemorate the family participation in their efforts. And then we had the guys that were on a mission like Apollo 12. They were all like Navy buddies, gum chewing, beer drinking Navy buddies before they were even astronauts. And they're putting in like Playboy bunnies on the checklist that they're carrying to the moon. And it's like they're playing practical jokes on each other going to the moon. And they had like one of the pilots of the lunar module like letting the other pilot take the controls while they were on the backside of the moon, and none of the NASA people. So it's like all the stories that were not a part of the corporate structures was what we put into these documentaries. And then we did like the Apollo 13 companion documentary, which told all the stories of the real life events surrounding the Apollo 13 mission, as opposed to what was fictionalized in the Tom Hanks version. That was actually quite accurate, by the way.
It's a great movie.
So it was unbelievably, but there were some few tweaks. There were a few tweaks that were it's kind of like if you remember the movie in the capsule, there's the two guys, I think Kevin Bacon and Gary Paxton, I think his name was. Well, that they were like infighting and arguing, and that just didn't happen in the real life. But I guess they had to like build up some angst and some drama in the movie version.
Well, yeah, you can't have a movie without some kind of atmosphere of, you know, there has to be some confrontation. You can't have them all sweet.
Drama and angst. Well, but, you know, they all knew that they were in trouble, and they all knew that whatever, you know, their arguments were going to be, that they would be back to square one when the arguments were done. So that was something that, you know, but it was something that our shows all portrayed, the real life, down to earth, touchy feely astronauts. And the NASA guys, that I don't know if you knew, that the Apollo 11 mission was like, you know, 2 seconds away from being aborted.
Wow.
Without this NASA engineer, you know, remembering his simulations and waving it off. So, you know, and then there was like another cute story that Neil Armstrong, he blew it as far as the one line that he was supposed to say when he landed on the moon.
What was he supposed to say?
Well, and you know, it was like, you know, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Uh-huh.
It was supposed to be one small step for a man.
Oh.
One giant leap for mankind. So, and then, like, just to fill you in on, like, a funny story that very few people know, is, like, there were the communists, and there were all of these naysayers that thought that Neil Armstrong's line was some propaganda, some government-created consultant that he forced Neil Armstrong to say when he landed on the moon. And the next commander was a guy named Pete Conrad for the Apollo 12 mission. And so he was fighting with this communist official, and he said, okay, well, let's bet that I'll just, like, we'll just make up some story for me to say right here and now, and I'll say it when I land on the moon. And, like, you know, let's bet, like, $1,000 or $500 or something. And so it's like they said something like, well, that could have been a small step for Neil, but it was a giant leap for me because I'm such a small guy. And like, because he was the shortest guy in the astronaut corps. So he landed on the moon, and he said something like, you know, well, that might have been one small step for Neil, but it was a big leap for a small guy like me. And so it's like he won the bet. That was like the genesis for the, like, you know, the cute little trivia points. In my documentary. Well, and then, you know, it's like there's like a part two to this story. Was I did the documentaries, and then I met up with, when I was producing the 2008 Hollywood Christmas Parade, I met up with John Goodwin of Galaxy Press, who sells the old sci-fi and adventure books and audiobooks of L. Ron Hubbard back in the 30s and 40s, who inspired some of the astronauts and NASA officials. And I was totally blown away with how this guy Hubbard was so accurate in writing his sci-fi books to what the real missions to the moon looked like. And Mr. Goodwin told me about his competitions known as Writers of the Future, and how many of today's futuristic writers use real-life events to provide the foundations of storylines and write about future space travel and colonization of planets. And so during our conversation, I realized that all these astronauts and NASA officials that I had long interviews with, I mean, of like an hour or sometimes 2 hours, is I only used 3 or 4 little 20-second sound bites, which never expressed the totality of their personal stories. So he inspired me to decide to compile the entire transcripts of the interviews for all the future historians and the next generation and beyond to produce a book on all of the actual interview statements made by all these astronauts and NASA officials, which is totally unique because there's no diluting of the storylines and there's no editorializing. It's all, like, you know, from the horse's mouth.
That's really cool.
And that's in my Space Pioneers book. Well, which you know, will be the foundation of all the future generations and future historians all giving, like, you know, laying the foundations for their stories of the future. So. It's like from the 1993, hearing about the Pulp Fiction era writers, and then doing the documentaries and interviewing all these astronauts, and then putting them in documentaries, and then making a book on the astronauts. It's like my way of giving back to society, and, like, you know, passing the torch to the next generation of historians.
I didn't mention in the green room that Neil Armstrong was a hero of mine.
Well, I mean, he was the nicest guy in the world. I was there. They were all at the in Washington, D.C. There was a big event, and all three of them sat down for interviews for us, lowly journalists. And they were, like, just the funny thing about astronauts is that they were all, like, covered the whole spectrum. I mean, like, Neil Armstrong was almost like, it was just another mission, it was just another test run, and others were, like, very religious, had a religious effect on them, and others had a very spiritual effect on them. I mean, and there was an astronaut that was doing ESP studies, and then there was another one that just totally became spiritual and became an artist, and a very famous one at that. So it's like they all had different responses and reactions to going to the moon.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because they were all test pilots, and so that's what they appreciated the most, was going out and going into, like, the cutting edge of technology, so to speak, and going, you know, where, what's that saying in Star Trek, going where no man had gone before,
yeah,
kind of thing. That's what they were, like, literally born and raised and trained to do, and it's like some of them, you know, it's like it didn't have any effect on them because that was their mission, and some of them totally, you know, became spiritual. And then they were, like, some of them were telling me how they would be on the moon, and they would look at the Earth that was like this little ball, and they would put out their thumb and say, my God, I have, like, 6 billion people, or whatever it is back then, and, like, 6 billion people are like, hidden by my thumb, or under my thumb.
I actually think that's a really important lesson for mankind to learn. I think one of my favorite pictures is the one Jim Lovell and I can't remember who else, but I think Bill Anderson took the picture. I can't remember. It was
Bill Anders.
Anders, that's it. Bill
Anders. The one on Apollo 8.
8, that's it. That is, like, one of the most...
Right.
Yes, because it's like that shows how vulnerable our planet is. That
correct. I mean, when you look at that was when it gave meaning to the word holistic, like holistic medicine, holistic views, you know, holistic perspectives. Is that was the photo that, like, you know, became the iconic version that gave that meaning, is like being able to see the whole planet Earth in one picture.
And has it transposed on top of the moon, as the moonrise over the moon, you just see that it's just another planet. It's not guaranteed to survive. It's not. We're just like all the other planets. We're, we should. Our egos are too big.
Well, right. I mean, there's one of my science colleagues at Caltech. He once calculated that, like there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, and of those 100 billion stars, there's like 100 million of them that are of the quality of our sun that would support life. And then of those 100 million stars that was of the size and age of our sun, there would be like 1 million or 2 million planets that would be orbiting such stars that would be within the life zone, like not too close to the sun and not too far away from the sun. So he calculated there were like 2 or 3 million planetary systems with life that equal our own, in our own, just in the galaxy. So there'll be like 2 million planets with life in our galaxy. And also the fact that there's no question that there was life on Mars that still exists today, that it's just below the surface, the surface of Mars is probably sterile because of the ultraviolet radiation that hits it, but below the surface is water and for into porous rocks, and within those little porous rocks with water, that there's bound to be life. There seems to be no question about that.
Yeah, didn't they actually show that with the last Mars mission that they that
Well, they showed there was definitely water on the planet, and they showed there was like exhaust gases from like a life form
Well,
that was in the rocks.
that's pretty
And so,
conclusive, isn't it?
so other than like, it's like circumstantial evidence. It's like, if you hear a gunshot, that if you smell like gunpowder, but you don't see a gun, you could go ahead and say, okay, that there was somebody that got shot. So it's like that we're finding all the things that other than actually finding a life form. And I don't know if you remember, like 10 or 15 years ago, there was the hysteria that the somebody like says that they found life on Mars, and it turned out to be a little bit bogus, because the rocks that they found the so-called life forms in,
Oh, they were
that they thought they were
contaminated.
fossilized.
They were
Well, that they
contaminated, right?
Well, no, it was because the rocks were igneous rocks, which was like from a lava flow. So
Oh.
igneous rocks are the wrong kinds of rocks that you would find a fossilized life form.
Ah,
On
okay.
Earth, all the life forms are in sedimentary rocks, not igneous rocks that are volcanic in nature.
Because
So it would have destroyed the igneous rocks, the igneous when it was in its molten lava form, would have destroyed the life form.
haven't they gotten further on Titan, finding life on
Well,
Titan?
Titan also probably has a life form, because I don't know if you're aware that the Earth in its early history was not like it is today. The Earth of the past was entirely composed of methane gas and carbon dioxide that was supportive of the first life forms, that's essentially pond scum. And so it was only later, when life forms gave off oxygen, which in cosmic terms is a deadly, poisonous, toxic corrosive gas, but that's apparently what was the genesis of our civilization and of the Earth changing over. Well, and so on Titan, there's a carbon dioxide and methane atmosphere, and the heat coming from Saturn would make it appropriate to be supportive of life.
I think that is.
But there's another moon of, I think it's either Saturn or Jupiter, that might also have life forms, and
it's a
moon called Europa.
Europa.
That is an entire moon full of
water and ice.
Of water. Well, with the ice is covering it because it's like a zero temperature. So it's got like this warm, moist interior and an ice covering, this protective shield. So there's probably all kinds of life forms swirling around in that water. And if you look at all forms, if you look at everywhere on Earth, every single place on the Earth where you find water, you find life.
I remember that because I remember that mission, and that they were all shocked because they all thought it was a dead planet because it looked like a big ice ball. And they did not expect the water, ocean underneath it. And
right.
It was a real shock to the scientists.
Right. And so what they think is that the main planet that Europa is orbiting is giving off the kind of heat to keep the interior warm that then ices over. So it's like the outer coating is ice, but the inner lining of being water is like heated up. So I don't think there's any doubt that there's life on those kinds of planets. It might not be anything that we are adjusted to. And it's kind of like, you know, the scientists that I've interviewed, the NASA scientists I've interviewed, have like defined life as, well, we don't really know, but when we see it, we'll know it.
I looked it up. It's Europa's Jupiter.
Right. Okay. So that's you know, the Jupiter is such a large planet that it gives off more heat than it gets from the sun.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that the reason that the ocean still exists is because it pulls it toward it, and then the planet pulls away to go around its axis around Jupiter, but the planet keeps pulling it toward it, so it's this action of moving back and forth that creates the dynamics that create the ocean as still active.
And so that's why it will be necessary to send a human mission out there, which goes back to these old Apollo missions, that what they found on our moon was the perfect fuel that will carry future generations of missions to these planets, that we're not going to be able to take all of the fuel off of the Earth and then to be able to go to these other planets. It's that we're going to be able to just get to the moon and then to use the moon as like a gas station and then to go from there onto these other planetary systems. Because it will be necessary to send humans out there to test for the life form. And this is all, like, the thing that, like, Harrison Schmitt on Apollo 17, they all found what's called helium-3, that is an element that comes off of the sun from the nuclear reactions of the sun, and that in the cosmic radiation just sticks onto the surface of the moon. So it's kind of like, just to visualize, one container full of helium-3 could provide the electricity for all of humanity for an entire year.
Isn't that fascinating?
And helium-3 is like for fusion reactions, like a like the difference between a hydrogen bomb and an atomic bomb. Is the atomic bomb takes a big atom like uranium, and the splitting of that atom is what creates all the energy. The fusion reactions are these two atoms that comes together and that has no byproduct, so no radioactive byproduct. So it's like a pure form of energy.
Isn't the magnetosphere the big thing that protects the Earth, that makes the aurora and everything? The magnetic field, but they call it magnetosphere. I don't know why, but that's what they call it. Anyway, isn't the one on Jupiter like 1,000 or maybe even more times bigger than the one on Earth?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why it's causing that?
Because of the size and the mass.
Because isn't that what's been protecting the Earth all these years?
Right. I mean, without a magnetic field that keeps the cosmic radiation and ultraviolet radiation from hitting the Earth directly.
And when the solar wind.
So, without that. Right. So when that's the solar wind, and that's what gives rise to the aurora borealis.
Right.
In the northern latitudes. That's all the cosmic radiation that's interacting with the magnetic field.
If we didn't have that solar wind would have made us like Mars.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. Because the radiation would have hit the Earth. I mean, it's like it's different from like the ozone layer that is like oxygen atoms that get hit by cosmic radiation, and that splits the atoms apart, and then the atoms then form with other atoms, and so it's kind of like another layer of protection.
That's why it's kind of dangerous with the space station to do a spacewalk, because anything can hit them, the space junk, the solar wind, anything, that they have to be really careful of what's going on in space before they even do a spacewalk. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but there's the spacesuits are designed to protect that sort of thing. For a short term. I mean, it's different to have it like have somebody being exposed to that kind of radiation for long periods of time.
Okay.
Which is one of the limiting factors of a Mars mission, is they've got all this cosmic radiation that is penetrating the capsules that would have a negative impact for like 2 or 3 years. That is the obvious duration for a Mars mission.
Is the stuff that's hitting the stuff on Mars hurting the rovers that are being sent up there?
Well, right, but they're already built in. That's already built into the, like, baked in the cake, is that kind of radiation. And it's not the rover itself that's in danger. It's the
computer.
It's the chips. The computers, the chips, the guts, the brain of the rovers.
Okay.
If the radiation gets into that and defries it, then that would have a negative impact on that.
It's so fascinating. I mean,
it totally is, and it's kind of like is for me, it's doing the book, doing the documentaries, and then seeing that this is going to be the next generation of like the space race to the moon, to getting a mining colony to mine this helium-3, with the Chinese or with the Russians, to get to the moon, to then be like a gas station to other planets, to Mars and beyond, to Europa, to Titan. That's all, in the future. That, it's like we're in on the ground floor.
Yeah, probably won't be around when it actually happens.
probably not, because, like I said before, it's going to be a process-oriented thing. Where different corporations, different companies, different nations are going to join forces, and it's the process of going and doing the thing, rather than like a goal, it's like a space race kind of thing. It's kind of like, who's going to make the more money? Who's going to get it first? Who's going to have the better equipment? And who's going to be able to use the facilities best? And then, of course, it's like we're in on the ground floor, like like when oil was found in like in the early 1900s, they never knew that we were going to be able to fly jets and do any of that stuff. So it's the same kind of thing with fusion reactors and helium-3, is we know the possibilities, we know the potentiality, but we just can't quite get it just yet that we can produce energy with fusion reactors, with helium-3, but it's at the moment, the amount of energy you have to put into the process isn't quite yet the same or greater than the amount getting energy that you get from that event. So it's like the technology is still in its infancy, but when we can put in a little energy and get a lot of it back that has no byproducts, no radiation, no nothing, that's pure energy, and it's like you get one shuttle bay container full of this helium-3 that would then satisfy your electrical needs for an entire year. That is something that's worthwhile. And we're talking about like a budget that's not that greater than, like the Alaska oil pipeline, going from the northern part of Alaska to the southern bay, or the tunnel in between the English, under the English Channel.
The channel.
Right. So, but the cost of that, the cost of the Alaska oil pipeline, is not that much less than a mining colony to the moon.
That's fascinating.
So, I
wanted to ask before we lose time about the women astronauts that you interviewed, because you told some about the men. So I think if women equal time, it's like Sally Ride, who's another one of my heroes.
Well, there is a story that we did a documentary on called Women Space Pioneers, and that dealt with the first group of women astronauts that were chosen in the mid-1970s as a part of the Equal Rights Amendment era. And the first group of women astronauts were all recruited by Nichelle Nichols,
who many
of you know as the first black woman to portray an astronaut on TV.
Uh-huh.
And we got her to play the host and narrator for our documentary on Women Space Pioneers, because she was an actress that portrayed a woman astronaut on TV, and she got on as a host for a real-life documentary about the first real group of women astronauts in the mid-1970s. Now, there is a cute little trivia story about the first group of women astronauts before then that were tested when the first group of Mercury 7 astronauts were chosen, like the John Glenn and the Wally Schirra's, the Gordon Cooper, is those guys were all tested and chosen because they were test pilots, top test pilots, top military people, top government security clearances, and so they were all tested, and this is like in the pre-NASA days, that they were tested at a hospital and by the doctor that created the and discovered the oxygen mask for bomber pilots in World War II. And so this was the guy that was the specialist for high altitude, like human body behavior. And so at the time that the men were tested, they also tested women pilots. That, you know, women pilots were all through World War II were flying all the bombers and the fighter planes from America to Europe. And they were the called the WASPs, and so a bunch of those women were also tested with the men, and as it turned out, they proved better at the oxygen consumption. They were smaller, they could fit in better into a Mercury capsule, their response times were better, their reaction to zero gravity, which at the time was just like a bed that the people got into, and then the bed was tilted, and all the blood goes from your brain and your heart into your legs, and that is what copied zero gravity. The women tested better than the men in all of those categories, except the fact that the technology that they were dealing with, rocketry and the space race and the missile technology, was all top secret, and it was like the Cold War era. And so because the women were not military with security clearance, they were deleted from any kind of possibility. And this was back in the early 1960s, late 50s, when the first group of astronauts were chosen. So that's a cute little trivia story there. And then, of course, when the Sally Rides and the Anna Fishers and those sorts of women were finally chosen in the mid-70s, there was tremendous pressure on them. And Kathy Sullivan, and all of them had tremendous pressure to be successful, because if they would have screwed up, then the men who were like these gum-chewing, beer-drinking astronauts, that a lot of them did accept the women right away, but some of them were thinking, like, you know, what are these women doing here? This is a man's job. And so they had to prove themselves over and above. And they did.
They did.
It was the success of all these women. It was the success of all these women that gave rise to all the future generations. And you know, when we interviewed all the first group of women astronauts, and we interviewed the first Eileen Collins, who was the first shuttle commander and shuttle pilot. And then we interviewed Kathy Helms, that was the first like a colonel or a general to fly in NASA. So it's like all of the women nowadays have to give thanks to the Sally Rides.
Yeah.
And then because being an astronaut was the last ultimate macho male occupation that was broken into. And so we did like two or three documentaries on those, and then we even did an audiobook because it was so popular, and that we felt that we wanted to do a show on not only, you know, using like two or three or four sound bites of these women, but to get their whole story on all the stuff that they had to deal with.
Yeah.
In becoming a pioneering, and you know, they didn't really care about being a pioneer or being a visionary or being like, you know, a role model. They just wanted to get the job done, and they just wanted to be doing something that they always wanted to do.
They wanted to go into space. That's just like any other person.
Right. And so they were given that opportunity, and they didn't screw it up. And that's something that was what I admired that tremendously.
Me too.
And that might be the next book I'm going to write, called Strong Women of the Skies.
How about Women Heroes of the Skies?
Well, could be.
I mean, they are really the ones who broke through the darn glass ceiling when it came to astronauts being women. They need a lot of pats on the back for that.
But you see, it's also the case that that's how it's always been. I mean, we interviewed, we did a documentary on the first woman to break the sound barrier. Her name was Jackie Cochran, and she has more altitude and speed records than any woman alive or dead. And then there's, you know, women that were flying bomber planes and fighter planes in World War II, back when, like, you know, women weren't supposed to be outside the kitchen kind of thing. So these are all, like, the women throughout history. And then, you know, we interviewed Gina Yeager, who was in on flying around the world in on a solar-powered airplane. And so it's like all these women do things that are pioneering and do things that are unique, and they should be, you know, recognized for their accomplishments.
Yes. Is Gina Yeager related to Chuck Yeager?
No.
Oh, okay.
And we interviewed Chuck Yeager because he was the teacher of this Jackie Cochran, who was the first woman to break the sound barrier. And the only reason that she was able to do that was because she had a millionaire husband who was on the board of governors of Lockheed. And it was like a rule that when Lockheed built one of their interceptor jets, until it was handed over to the military, it would belong to Lockheed. And so he hired his wife to be a test pilot, and so she was flying in like Mach 2 or Mach 3 jet fighter interceptors that the military used. And she had Chuck Yeager teach her, and it was like Chuck Yeager would charge her in like Edwards Air Force Base, would charge her $10,000. This is like back in 1950, you could buy a house for $10,000, but it's like for insurance and for the time and for the travel and everything, that they charged $10,000 for each session. But she did it, and she was able to pay for it with the husband, and she was the first woman to break the sound barrier.
But she did it, and she did it safely. That's the point. She broke the sound barrier, and she did it safely.
Exactly. Well, and she had talent. She had ability, and she had talent. And so Chuck Yeager was the guy that he was the one that was teaching her, and he had some, you know, some serious things to say that was tremendous. So it's like, you know, women in space, women aviators. There's no limits to their potential.
That's true. And, I mean, even the current ones, the ones that are right now training for is it the Mars project or the Moon project, that there's a big training thing going with the astronauts?
Well, probably the Moon, that's the Artemis project.
There's a lot of women astronauts and male astronauts, of course, training for that, and they're like the best of the best.
Right, and so this is all. What I've always said is, it doesn't matter men, women, black, white, purple, whatever. Is just like whoever is the best suited, the best, has the best talent, and who could do the job the best should get the job.
Yeah.
Should get the spot.
Yeah. I agree. I'm just proud that these women did it.
Well, right. So, but it's that with the proper training, anybody could do this.
Yeah,
with the proper training and the discipline and
you have
the
to
focus.
Have talent too, though.
And, well, right. So, but then this is what the weeding out process is all about. Is you're not just assigned to a spot. Is you have to earn the spot. And that's the way that NASA's been all along from the very beginning. And that's also an admirable point to make. So.
We're coming to the end. Are your documentaries available? And where can people buy your book?
Well, yes, people can buy the book, The Space Pioneers: Conversations with the Men of Apollo. You can find that on Amazon.com or any number of other book sites. I have another book, Legends of the Court, that's a show on a book on basketball art, Hall of Famers, and these documentaries I've done are all on like Hulu and YouTube and Vimeo, and there's like Tubi and Pluto, and it's just like they're all over the place. My distributors are just so like wild with these different sites now, where that are just streaming video. So, but these are shows that I've even done like 20 or 25 years ago. That something that I got to point out is that a show I did 25 years ago with all these astronauts that had its significance back then adds to the significance now that they're all like passed away or they're not giving any more interviews, and so it adds to the historical significance of like what these astronauts and people like are saying, because it's not, there's no more interviews, and so they're still available on the streaming sites because the historical significance has in fact been added on. So shows I did 25 years ago are just as applicable today as it was back then.
Cool. And do you have anything, a new book coming out or any new stuff that you want to let people know about?
Well, I do have my next book. My next book is going to be called Strong Women of the Skies, and it's going to deal with all the pioneers of aviation and space travel. So we talked about the Sally Rides. The first EVA was Kathy Sullivan. The first woman to break the sound barrier was Jackie Cochran. The first woman, Gina Yeager, was the first woman to fly around the world without stopping on a solar-powered airplane. And so that's going to be our next show. Our next book is all the transcripts of the interviews with all of these people that we're compiling just to show the world the entirety of their interviews for future generations and future historians.
Cool. And
And also, if you wanted to stop off in my website at www.globalscienceproductions.com.
That's funny, because that was what I was going to ask you. What's your
Well, I just
website?
thought I'd give me like one plug on this.
Also, are you on any social media in case people want to say
Yes,
hi?
I'm on a Facebook, Dr. Elliot Hamoff, and there's also like Instagram.
Are you under the same name, or is it a different name on Instagram?
Yeah.
It's the same name.
Well, yeah, but it's also Hoop Innovators. That's my sports, for any of you sports fans out there.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I wanted
It
to.
is a tremendous pleasure
Oh.
talking about space.
It's really cool. I really enjoyed it. I want to thank you for taking time out of your day for coming on my show. I really appreciate it.
It, like I said before, it was a tremendous honor being with you here today.
Thank you.
So take care of yourself. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And
Bye-bye.
thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thank you. Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Cox offers fiber-powered speeds from the nation's fastest internet provider. Double up on the value when you add Cox Mobile for a combination of lightning-fast home internet and unbeatable 5G reliability on the go. Cox internet is powered by fiber and connected to the premises via coaxial cable. Nation's fastest based on average download speeds from highspeedinternet.com tests in 2023. Individual speeds vary. Learn more at cox.com.